Devotees of Monty Python's Flying Circus, this week are relishing a new documentary on the group sometimes described as the Beatles of comedy. Appropriate for our chat before about Abbey Road this afternoon. As a new doco, I haven't actually caught it yet, but I believe it's very good. I've got them on DVD. I'm going to have a look at them tonight, currently showing on the ABC. Who better to discuss the Pythons but a person who has always inspired countless thousands, probably millions, in humour and many other things, but comedian, author, good friend of mine, director, and New Zealander, Tony Martin. Good afternoon, Tony.
Good afternoon, Michael. It's very nice being on a very polite afternoon radio program.
Well, I'm hoping you're going to lower the tone somewhat.
Well, here's what you need. On a show like this, I always like it when there's some weird sort of electronic sounds. Like, I'll often be on a show and it'll be, and next up we'll be speaking to Tony Martin. Meow, meow, meow. Just a few of them. Well, sorry, I haven't right. seen the Monty Python documentary.
There's... It's called The Lawyer's Cut or something like that. It's one of the... they are kind of like the Beatles in that their fame seems to be kind of amplifying the more the time elapses since they actually did anything together.
That's right. I mean, when was the last time they were... There was that get-together at the Aspen Comedy Festival where they appeared on stage with the ashes of Graham Chapman and somebody knocked them over.
Yes.
I think that was technically the last new bit of Monty Python material.
It's easy. It's funny because I actually had the opportunity to interview Michael Palin for Sunday Arts a few years ago, and it was he is as delightful a bloke as people sort of say he is. But the thing about it, the thing I realise about Michael Palin is that Michael Palin is actually a Python nerd.
That's right. Well, he is. And we spoke to him as probably at the same time as you. Me and Mick Molloy had him on our show for a whole hour. And we were so nervous about bringing up Monty Python. We're going, he's probably sick of it. So we talked about his world trips for 55 minutes. And at the very end, we thought, let's mention a sketch that, you know, probably not many people mention. And it's the one where a whole lot of people who have been in a shipwreck are out at sea and they're deciding who in what order they're going to eat each other. And they're saying we could have him with some white wine sauce and then serve him up as leftovers the next day. And like, he was just, you know, it was like that's what he'd wanted, you know, been wanting to talk about. He'd been wanting us to bring up that.
Yes, absolutely. Despite, in a way, he's... He's always remained the most accessible of the Pythons, hasn't he?
That's right. I just read, I think there's another volume of his autobiography.
Yes.
His
diaries. Kind of an autobiography. They serve as an autobiography, don't they?
And he does seem like a very nice, he seems almost too nice for his own good.
Yes, really,
when you read them. Although it's great to, the diaries are great because I don't think he ever thought they were going to be published. So it's I remember the excerpts from those diaries that appeared in the enormous Monty Python coffee table autobiography a few years ago. They were the first time that you actually got inside the writing room and sort of discovered that, yes, like every comedy group, there were constant fights.
Tony, you probably know more than most. What were the kind of creative, artistic divisions amongst the Monty Python people? Where did the lines fall?
Well, I think it was John Cleese was kind of the person who got the whole show up. Everyone had been working kind of with each other throughout the 60s on shows like The Frost Report, and there was a show called At Last, the 1948 show.
Yes.
There was another show called Twice a Fortnight. And, of course, there was a kids' show, which I actually remember seeing in New Zealand, called Do Not Adjust Your Set.
Oh, yes.
And they'd all worked in various combinations. But Cleese
was that program, I'm sorry, I'll read that again?
That was on the radio. That was just with Cleese and the Goodies were in it.
Yes, Graham Garden, I think, was in it as well.
Cleese was kind of the biggest name, and he got, you know, the chance to do his own show, and so he just got everyone he'd wanted to work with, and Chapman he'd been writing with for years,
yes.
And Palin and Jones were a comedy writing team, and then Eric Idle sort of worked on his own, and Terry Gilliam had been doing the animations for Do Not Adjust Your Set, so Cleese sort of brought them in, and I think the BBC were expecting the John Cleese show, and
right.
he kind of very generously said, no, let's have it be a six-man group. But I think throughout the history of Monty Python, there was no doubt that John Cleese was in charge. I think he left before the end of it, of course.
Did he? I didn't realise that. What, under what circumstances?
Well, there were three... It's getting really nerdish now.
No, please. That's what I've got you on.
There were three series of Monty Python's flight.
I actually Googled Australia / New Zealand Monty Python nerd, and lo and behold, you came up, Tony. It isn't for your inherent comedy credentials, I assure you.
You would have grown up with this stuff at the same time as, I mean, when we started in the degeneration, Python was still a constant reference point in the mid-80s.
Yes.
It's sort of gone out of fashion now, really, I think. But
Taking you away from what you were very interested in explaining how it lay. Now, did they all meet at Cambridge? Were they all undergraduates at Cambridge?
I think it was a split down the middle. I think Cleese and Chapman were at Cambridge, and Palin and Jones and possibly Eric Idle were at Oxford.
Yes.
At the same time. And Cleese had worked, bizarrely, with Terry Gilliam years earlier on a photo comic strip for a magazine called Help, made by Harvey Kurtzman, who made Mad Magazine back in the early 60s. So they had known each other for years. But no, I always remember I was never allowed to watch Monty Python. It was on really late at night. And there was a sketch, I'm sure people would remember it, called Sam Peckinpah's Salad Days. Do you remember that?
Yes.
It was sort of a lot of, you know, boaters and blazers and around the piano, you know, in a garden, like a Merchant Ivory film that turned incredibly violent, like the Wild Bunch. And that was such a notorious sketch in New Zealand that, you know, word got around, you can't let your kids watch this show. So I never saw Monty Python's Flying Circus until the very last series, the fourth series, which was in, I think, 1974, that was just called Monty Python. They snipped off Flying Circus because John Cleese had left by that time. And that is really quite a poor series. I mean,
they're the one where the sketches, it's basically one elongated, rambling sketch with very little jokes that goes for 20 minutes.
It's really quite... I mean, I can watch the original 39 episodes, the first three series, just over endlessly, over and over again, but that last six, you put them on and you go, it's like the David Bowie Tin Machine albums. You go, I'll listen to them just for completion, but I never want to watch them again. It's wrong without John Cleese. But luckily, he came back for the movies.
Yes, yes. Did they... We were talking about the Beatles before because, as you may know, today EMI have put Abbey Road Studios up for sale, which is shocking a lot of Beatles fans.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Because EMI is in a bit of financial trouble, as it happens. But were there the kind of bitter divisions like what happened in the Beatles? Were there people not speaking to each other?
They joke about it now, as I guess you would when you get to their age, but I think there was very much a sort of a rivalry between Terry Jones and John Cleese, and Cleese was kind of the leader, but Terry Jones was the one who was most active in the group taking control of their own material and directing it themselves.
Yes.
And he sort of got out and directed I think he directed most of the location footage, and that was quite unusual for someone who was in a show to start directing, and I think Cleese kind of resented that, but at the same time respected that he was improving them at the same time. There's always been a weird tension between those two, and, you know, when you've been in a comedy group, as you would know, it's kind of a relief to hear that even at the top echelon, that this sort of dynamic is replicated.
Yes, yes. If you've got people listening, if you've got a favourite Monty Python sketch, give us a call, 1300 222 936, 1300 222 936, or SMS us on 1992 936. I'm talking to comedian, author, director, polymath, whatever, Tony. I can't keep up with all the things that you're
actually
doing.
My motto is, why do one thing properly when you can do a number of things with middling success?
Oh, how nicely put. Someone once described the creative flavours of the kind of dual writing team of Python was that the sketches beginning with someone in a kilt walking across a field were written by
Palin and Jones,
and someone walking in into an office going, "Ah, Mr. Johnson, good afternoon." We were written by Cleese and Graham Chapman.
Any time there was a shop providing poor service, that was Cleese and Chapman. I think my favourite Cleese and Chapman is the one about the guy who's hired to design an apartment block and thinks he's designing an abattoir.
An abattoir, yes. Wonderful. I've got a favourite. My favourite is an relatively obscure one. Didn't make it to any of the records or anything. It was the, I think the, one of those Norse sagas. Jones was obsessed with Norse mythology, which I think he studied at Cambridge or Oxford, wherever he went. And so he was Jarls of Sweden or something like that. And it's this Viking saga, you know, travelling across the seas and the sort of North England, and suddenly it devolves into a travelogue for a kind of for the city of Maldon. And the mayor comes out to meet the Viking. "Yes, everyone's welcome to Maldon, where business enterprise is on the go." And the Viking going, "Hang on, what the hell's going on here? This was my film about walking across the..."
That's right, it's a Viking saga sponsored by the Maldon City Council.
That's right.
The thing that you kind of forget about Monty Python is the famous sketches, and we know what they are, have been thrashed to death so much that they're almost impossible to get any enjoyment out of. It's like a song you've heard on the radio too many times. But when you find a sketch that you'd forgotten about, they're like brand new over again.
Yes, absolutely, aren't they? How many shows did they make?
Well, it was just 3 series of 13 was Monty Python's Flying Circus. I think it was 69, 70, and then another one in 72. And then there were there was the terrible 4th series, and then there were the movies. So, I mean, it's not... And the albums, of course, people forget the albums.
Yes.
That was where I heard the material first, because I couldn't watch the TV show. I heard the albums, and they've been inspiring me for years, and every sketch I've ever done on radio, I owe something to those sketches, because I think the first album was just, it wasn't the soundtrack of the TV series, but it was just them recreating the sketches in front of a live audience. But from the second album on, they went into the studio and made amazing kind of use of all of the sound. I mean, the sound effects and the production on the Python albums are just absolutely brilliant. Recorded things, you know, added new bits.
I think Matching Tie and Handkerchief, where there's a double track on the on the LP, where you put the needle on and the sketches sort of play through to the end, and then the next time you listen to it on the same side, it's totally different, because they had two equally aligned grooves with totally different material.
Concurrent grooves, that's right.
I beg your pardon?
Yeah, concurrent groove. Kind of a crapshoot as to which one you were going to land on. Somebody told me that was actually something that, like, all records used to have back in the 1920s. That might be wrong. Although when I was a kid, do you remember something called the Racing Game? It was an LP with horse racing commentaries, and it had 8 different variations, and you could bet money on what the outcome of the race was going to be.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I've diverted us.
Well, you've actually reminded me of something. Your inspiration of
a Python Senate inquiry.
Here we go. That's the news butting in a very Pythonist kind of way. I didn't put the newsreel button down. What you were saying about experimenting with records, you actually did something similar. I'm reminded that on the CDs, the Python did this thing where they only have one giant track, so you can't get to the sketch you want. Something that you, I remember, from my own memory, insisted on when we did, the satanic sketches. Is that right?
How annoying was that? That was very annoying. That was our first studio album, and I was very much influenced by Monty Python, tried to get as many things on there, and I tried to think of something that they hadn't done. So if you look at the vinyl copies of that album, if you look at, you know, the runoff grooves, there's about a centimeter between each of the runoff grooves, so there's just flat black plastic.
Yes.
In every single copy of that album, hand scratched by me is the phrase, "Don't buy this one, it's scratched." You can actually see it if you hold it up to the light. It is there on every copy.
How did you do that?
We had to go to the place where Michael Gadinsky had to drive me to the place where they make the record so we could do that. I don't think that's been done before. Maybe it has.
Wow. Well, I hope you numbered them. You should have done
it. I'll tell you something else we did on one of our albums, which was probably inspired by Monty Python. It's on that album, The Satanic Sketches, there's a backwards message, which is, it's where somebody's reading a note and the note's upside down, so, you know, the voice part is backwards.
Yes.
But if you actually play that backwards, it's Mark Downey's voice saying, you realise you're buggering up your needle by doing this. Doesn't make much sense on a CD.
Try playing a CD background. Now, further to our mutual past, Tony Martin, I have a text here. Hey, Michael, did Tony really fill your car with bananas years ago? from Justin in Sydney. Justin, I can affirm that yes.
Well, I can give Tom Gleisner in Santo Chilao and myself, and it was National Banana Day, and we had 20 crates of bananas delivered to the radio station, and we thought, we'll put them in Michael Veach's car, assuming that you would go down at 9 o'clock at the end of the show and find them, and it would be a humorous visual joke. Unfortunately, you then had to go and film Fast Forward all day.
Yes, I did.
On a really hot day. And I think your car was filled with sludge. When you got back.
The black sludge of burst bananas on a plus 40 degree day in a 1981 Toyota Corona.
I blame Banana Day. It was an irresponsible thing to do.
No, I blame you, Tony. I blame you. Now, Tony, you've had your second book out recently, haven't you?
Yes, I have. A Nest of Occasionals.
Because your first was completely autobiographical, really, account of your growing up in New Zealand and coming to Australia in Lolly Scramble.
That's right. I'm glad to be on Tasmanian radio because people in Tasmania know the phrase Lolly Scramble. It's never quite made it to the mainland. It's a New Zealand phrase. But I am told by my brother-in-law that it is in use down there.
That's when you chuck lollies up in the air and run for them, isn't it?
That's right.
Oh, there you
go. Simple as that.
It must be the school that you went to. But you now can you say this officially? You're going to be doing a bit of directing for the ABC, is that right?
I think I'm going to be either doing some directing or some second unit directing on The Librarians on Series 3. I'm basically just helping Wayne Hope out because people might not be aware that Wayne, who is in The Librarians, is also the director of the show.
And is married to the leading lady, Robin Butler.
To Robin Butler, and Wayne didn't have a lot to do in the first series, but he had a lot more to do in the second series, so he's going to have me being kind of his stunt double for Series 3, which I think is filming in a couple of months, depending on when we can get the library.
Indeed. Now, isn't it the story of that, where they film it, it's only available for a couple of weeks, a year or something? It is actually a library in the suburbs of Melbourne somewhere?
It is incredible. The first one was actually constructed in an old Mercedes showroom in South Melbourne, but that's since been pulled down. So I think it was it would be called the Flemington Showgrounds. We Thank God You're Here is film now.
Oh, okay.
They set up a library, and it's actually, you have no idea how many books you need to physically make a fake library. It's more books than you could ever imagine.
Oh, really? It would be.
You can have a lorry load of books delivered, and it looks a bit like you filled about three shelves. So it's a massive job.
Oh, great. Well, is it the second or third series of The Librarians that they're...
It'll be the third series. It's
terrific.
Yeah, it's proving very popular.
Well, you directed your crime film a few years ago.
Yes,
sorry,
I've
blanked on the name. It's no reflection on its success.
It was possibly an ill-advised name. We're setting ourselves up for reviews with that name. And I should point out, Michael, that in Germany, where the film, in a sort of David Hasselhoff-ish style move for myself, has done quite well, it is called Mit vollem Einsatz, which means, I think, with extreme force.
Yes, yes. Well, that roughly translates as bad eggs, doesn't it?
I think so. There was actually a German film called Bad Eggs, Rotag, made in 1946, so maybe they were trying to avoid confusion.
Tony Martin, it's been great talking to you about Monty Python and everything else, as always. Thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Michael, and a belated apology for the bananas.
I'll never forgive you ever. Ever, ever, ever. Goodbye, Tony.
Cheers. Bye.